This is Philosophy of the People with Stefan Bertram and only Stefan Bertram. There's no Ben, and there's no essay from Ben. So I thought I'd be very, very brave, and not just monologue for the first time, but monologue live for the first time. As I presume you can see from the title, I've also decided to monologue on some, I don't know, dark topics, people would like to say, obviously inspired by current events. But topics I'm very much interested in, and I have about 2,500 words of notes, which will hopefully get us through to the end. So I'm going to begin talking about suicide, going into things like hunger strikes, self-immolation, and suicide bombings, which I decided, I was always trying to talk about suicide bombings, but I decided not to put it in the title and not to put it in the description, because I think the title alone by itself is provocative enough without also including suicide bombing. But I think suicide is one where it's very good. Suicide is a topic which is very useful for kind of revealing and thinking about and trying to really grapple with what is right and what is wrong and why things are right and why things are wrong. A bugbear I go on about quite often on this channel is the what I call consent model of morality, where something is permissible such that it's the case that it was consensual and it's wrong in the case that it's non-consensual. Why is killing yourself bad? Well, one reason, if we're going to think about why killing yourself is bad, we should probably think about the reasons why killing someone else is bad. Because unless we have some reason to discriminate, we should treat ourselves as we treat others. This can kind of be a hard thing to grasp, both because we think of ourselves as special, but also because we have an idea of morality as if it only is about the things that we do to each other. And as I'll come on to later, this is why kind of the rejection of suicide is often framed around altruistic motives, as in you shouldn't kill yourself because you'll harm others or something like this. This, I think, is a bad way to frame things because I think it's quite possible to show that suicide is almost always wrong for the person, and you don't need to bring in these altruistic reasons which kind of demand on the face of it that someone... Sorry, reading the comments. That someone live on despite the fact that they're miserable. One reason that it might be bad to kill people is that they don't consent to it. People don't want to be killed, generally. And we think that in cases where people do want to be killed, there's at least a possibility that it's right. Generally, people think that when in countries where euthanasia is illegal, when someone's partner kills them because they were suffering in great agony and they demanded it, that at the very least that person has done something which is not obviously wrong. It may be right what they did, depending on the circumstances, and so on. This obviously doesn't work for suicide, because we take it, and this seems reasonable, that in some sense, everyone consents to their own suicide. If they don't, if it's not a self-willed action, then it's not really suicide. You can try to modify this, because obviously, once that's said, you go one of two ways, which is either to say suicide is always wrong, is always permissible. It's always, if consent is the only thing which is required for someone to be moral, and suicide is always consented to, then we kind of just have to accept that suicide is permissible. The other thing to do is to try to modify this, to complicate the account of a consent-based morality, which is to say, why are all the comments on the paired link on the GTAA are irrelevant. There's just someone called Shane Moon talking about Randy Kelleher. Interesting. Anyway, it's put me off, but I'll survive. Or you can complicate the account of consent-based suicide by saying it doesn't count if you're not in your right mind, which, you know, is a plausible enough account because we say the same, for instance, as regards to like sexual relationships and so on, that there are some circumstances which we engage in an act in what seems like a consensual way, but this doesn't add up to substantive consent. But this kind of relies on the idea that anyone that engages in suicide... Thank you for the $5. Oh, right, okay. Okay, I understand now, Shane Moon. As we will talk about later with Aaron Bushell, we can see that with something like self-immolation, everyone is saying this guy is insane, that he's mentally ill. Why? The only reason we have for thinking this is because he did the thing, not for any other reason. Rather, it's taken that the act itself proves this to be true, which is just a kind of circular backwards logic. It also doesn't work really for normal killing. You need to immediately move to this idea of a hypothetical consent, as in they would consent if they were asked. Because obviously, you know, we don't all go around thinking, I don't want to be killed, I don't want to be killed, I don't want to be killed. But rather we're thinking, rather we're never thinking that, more or less, apart from at the point where our life is threatened. But very often, when people are killed, they have no idea that it was about to happen. You know, if a sniper shoots you in the back of the head, you never knew this was about to happen, so the consent would have to immediately move to a hypothetical stage. But also, it doesn't really work because if someone came to me, and however, I knew that this is a healthy, happy, well-adjusted person, and they seem, even if they seem as they ask me in their right mind and so on, if they ask me to kill them, it's still bad. It still seems bad. Why is this? Because there's more going on to right and wrong than consent. So either consent only matters in relationship to other values, which we're going to talk about, or it only matters to the degree to which it represents other values. In the sense, maybe happiness is the only thing that matters, and people don't like to do things they don't consent to, so consent matters to that degree. A common way to justify suicide, and to know, I am coming from this from a slightly weird angle, because my main relationship to suicide is when basically miserable young people will use Reddit Ask Philosophy as, you know, something almost like a suicide helpline. And usually these posts are removed, but these people are coming from the perspective of like, why is it wrong for me to kill myself? And they're very often, you know, the only reason that they can give for why they shouldn't is based on this altruistic idea that I shouldn't kill myself for other people. And so you talk to these people and you try to convince them that, no, actually, almost always, someone shouldn't kill themselves for their own sake. A common way to justify suicide is to make the claim that this person's interests and desires, either we talk about someone's actual suicide, or if we're speaking from the first person, about the hypothetical suicide of yourself. In the sense that, you know, it's right for me to commit suicide because I want to commit suicide. It fits with my desires and my interests because I have at least this desire to kill myself. But this is also a claim which is very problematic if we think about it. Namely, if we value the desire to commit suicide, this presumably comes not from particularly valuing the idea of a desire to commit suicide, but rather because we value desire in general. And the proper way to treat this, as with the not murdering thing, is to generalize it, you know. It's not the case that it's fine to murder someone if they're not presently thinking, I don't want to die, but it's not the case that we can ignore all of the desires simply because we want to commit suicide. We need to think not desire, not just in this very basic sense of it has to be in our head, but rather we should think about what a person's desires should be generally in hypothetical terms, and also in terms of just, you know, in terms of what a rational person would want in their position, but also what their actual desires are, even when they're not immediately thinking about them. We can have things, attributes of our inner personality and feelings and desires, which are features of ourselves, even if they aren't at any moment, any particular moment, consciously thought. Thus, any valuation of suicide on the basis of it being a desire must assess this in the context of this person's other desires. And since suicide permanently annihilates the possibility of fulfilling any other desire, it's almost certainly not going to be justified over all these other desires. Oh, fuck. I did the thing with chat where I clicked on it and it stopped. It stopped giving me more comments. But when I finish the suicide section, I'm going to go back and scroll through and read them because it's really hard to do all of these things just by myself. But, you know, I'm learning and growing, etc., etc. So what is the actually justifiable conditions for suicide? The justified conditions of suicide would be the case when a person's desires are overwhelmingly constituted, not just by a desire for suicide, but things like, I wish I didn't have to do X, I want to stop feeling pain. When all of our desires are constituted in this very negative way, such, well, not necessarily all of them, but overwhelmingly, even, kind of the case of the person whose suicide we accept is very right, it's not like, you know, if we had a magic wand to radically change our circumstances, there would be other desires there. But rather, in their present circumstance, and without a plausible way to get out of it, all or most of their desires are constituted by suicide and by things that would be fulfilled by suicide, such as, I don't wish I didn't have to go to work, I wish I could stop feeling pain, and so on and so forth. As mentioned earlier, I don't want to focus here on the impact suicide has on others. You can obviously do that yourself and then thus cut down the account of how many suicides are legitimate, even in the case that the suicides are, there's less suicides which are permissible or whatever else. But I want to make, I say that for the sense of arguing and thinking it's clear that in most cases, for most people who commit suicide, they should not have done it for their own sake. I think talking about others in this circumstance capitulates the framing I want to argue against, which basically takes it that in of itself as regarding the actions of the suicide. I'm using suicide in the old-fashioned sense to refer to as, you know, the person who's committed suicide or wishes to commit suicide. That the actions of the suicide are justifiable and that they can only be rejected in relation to others. But I think if we want to argue against suicide, we should always frame them around the interests of the person itself. To demand that someone to go on in conditions which are unlivable and seem to be unalterable does not seem to be a justifiable demand. The problem here is that basically every suicide thinks that this is the case for them. But very often it isn't, and this is very often something which is realized by the suicide as soon as they do it, where often, very often, someone will try to kill themselves and fail, and then they'll be like, okay, I definitely didn't want to do that. That's not always the case, obviously, and some people will try to commit suicide repeatedly throughout their lives. But it is very often the case that people will go one and done with this. Thanks, Taiki. Yeah, I mean, I don't think a nuanced perspective on suicide is something which can is not going to go on YouTube. I mean, last week also got demonetized, so maybe this is just the demonetized show now. Rather, that when confronted with the suicide, the proper moral task is not to demand that they remain among the living for our sake, but rather to attempt to change their circumstances, which possibly may justify the action that they are that they wish to do. I think this is what's really become problematic with euthanasia in the context of the neoliberal state. I'm very unenthusiastic about euthanasia, even though I think theoretically it's definitely, there's obviously circumstances where euthanasia is permissible, as with suicide. In the case of the very terminally ill and the very disabled, a person who we can say very reasonably will only see suffering and a frustration of desires and so on, whatever moral standard you wish to reach in their future, and they are sufficiently disabled that they can't possibly really kill themselves, and rather the person that would have to kill themselves would be their loved one and so on, which can very much get them in trouble. Euthanasia seems permissible in those circumstances. But the claims about a slippery slope in terms of euthanasia within the context of a neoliberal state seem to be true. They basically just seem to be true. What's occurring, it seems, in Canada and Netherlands and probably other people, is the state, instead of saying something like, we will kill you because there's truly no way for you to live a life worth living, rather, they are saying, we will kill you because we don't have the budget to make your life worth living within a particular political economy. You know, so instead of killing yourself or killing others, simply change the world, which neatly brings us on to the topics which we'll be talking about for the rest of the show, which are kind of altruistic forms of suicide in the other sense, of suicide or suicidal actions done for the sake of trying to change political circumstances. And I'm going to read the comments for a minute or two. It is, I'm not sure if this is actually a good format, because it will just lead to me being silent for a couple of minutes. So yeah, maybe I won't do that. Maybe I should just go on. Maybe I should just stop and interrupt myself as I read the comments. It's just hard to do this alone. I mean, it would be easy if I just ignored you all. Or I could just accept that I would go silent for a while. I should have watched a Vaughn video before I did this to see what kind of like delays and ums and ahs are acceptable. Yes, that would be good. That would be good, honestly. What is the stance on hunger strikes? We're a couple of sections away, mate. We'll get there eventually. What am I going with next? Where are we going? Ah, we're starting with suicide bombings. Well, we're actually starting with other forms of altruistic suicide. Especially in ancient cultures. And as me and Faky13 recently saw in Shogun, quite recently in Japan, it was very common to commit, based on kind of cultural circumstances, an altruistic suicide. Yes, seppuku. To protect your family's honor, to protect your family's property. For instance, it may be the case that someone that's executed for the state for whatever crimes loses all their property and their family loses all their property. But rather in the case of a suicide, the property passes on to their relatives. And in many pre-Christian cultures and cultures that were never Christian, suicide was considered the honorable and correct way out of many situations. And there's been for a very long time the idea of a forlorn hope military action, which is when you send soldiers on an operation which, you know, the aim is not for them to be killed, but the result is almost certainly that they will be killed. I think that's his norm. But there was a qualitative change, if we're going to get Kantian, between these Forlorn Hope attacks and what happened with the introduction of suicide bombing. It is interesting with suicide bombing, is that suicide bombing probably could have been a thing 100, maybe 200 years older, further back in time than it was. The first suicide bombing only happened in 1970, but not being a complete expert in munitions, but, you know, knowing a thing or two, it is something which could have happened much earlier, and it's interesting it didn't. But by suicide bombing, we're referring to specifically here the deliberate action. Yeah, the kamikaze is a related idea. Yeah, actually, how did I forget about kamikaze? So yeah, kamikaze is the same sort of thing as suicide bombing, specifically because you're ordering the death of the person. The act is intending for the person involved to be killed. And, you know, it's not kind of surprised that Japanese culture produced the first of these sorts. But of course, suicide bombing has become prominent instead to the West through Muslim culture, where the first suicide bombings happened in the 1970s in Lebanon. You might want to say, is there really a difference between ordering someone to a near certain death and a certain death? But in fact, ordering someone to do a suicide bombing isn't actually ordering them to a certain death. Some suicide bombers survive, some kamikaze pilots survive, but only because the mission went wrong. That's the problem with suicide bombing and with kamikaze and all kind of related stuff. What happens, you would want, you know, throughout, when kind of we order people to do something, we shouldn't will their death for the same reasons that we talked about before of why killing is bad. Hopefully we can accept in general that killing people is bad. And in the case of suicide bombing, what is willed towards is the certain death of the operative that you sent out. Your cadre, your soldier, your supporter, whoever they are, you are willing their death. The operation, in contrast to any other kind of military operation, goes best when that person dies. And that is bad. Suicide bombers are usually volunteers. And often, I mean, you want them to be volunteers because otherwise you're sending them into enemy territory normally, often in civilian environments or not necessarily. ISIS, for instance, use suicide bombings in kind of direct military operations. But for instance, in their usage in the Palestine war, for instance, normally suicide bombers go into the enemy civilian population and detonate there. But obviously someone that's been sent in to do this but doesn't really want to can simply disarm themselves and surrender to the police or the army. But as we noted with the argument says suicide, we shouldn't accept that simply because someone has volunteered to do something that it's fine for them to do it. It also kind of the whole idea of engaging in suicide bombings, having kind of a military culture and a political culture which favours suicide bombings, indicates a movement which is, you know, in love with death to some degree. Obviously, suicide bombings are sometimes engaged in because they're kind of the only option in asymmetrical warfare, but it's also often that they become very much, people become in love with them. It becomes within this culture of martyrdom, which is something I would like to talk about, but something which deserves a full hour on its own. Yes, a very, very common thing, and one which, you know, I think that it's a very delicate thing with the culture of martyrdom. I'm a lot more martyrdom-pilled than kind of the average Western leftist, I think, because of my kind of political upbringing, which happened through in large part the Kurdish freedom movement, which is very much on the martyr train and is only one of two secular organizations in history who've ever done suicide bombings. Because usually what's going on with suicide bombings in other cultures is that they're religious, as in they believe in an immortal soul, and suicide bombing is kind of diminished in its annihilation of the heroic subject because they are allegedly going on to an afterlife and specifically guaranteeing themselves in a good place of it because of their actions. Discussing in the context of the fact that people choose this for themselves, we can go on to talk about self-immolation. Self-immolation, in contrast to suicide bombing, I think we can fairly say is something which is not normally actually ordered by a central authority. Rather, self-immolation is a voluntary sort of suicide, normally done by individuals aimed at achieving certain ends. It's an unusual sort of act because it doesn't directly strike whatever enemy. Rather, it strikes out only at the believer. In contrast to suicide bombings, where you are trying to kill whoever the alleged enemy are, with self-immolation, the only person you're trying to kill is yourself in a very public manner. And the only person who's destroyed with his actions is kind of the most dedicated cadre of a certain movement, which is why, in contrast to suicide bombing, I don't think there's any movement out there which is really, really committed to self-immolation as a tactic, and rather it normally remains something that individuals do who are on the fringes of the movement. Yeah, and obviously, as Dusty says, and I'm going to come on to, it relies on the idea of appealing to the conscience of the enemy in part, but there's also another factor that we'll come on to. There's something also very particular about self-immolation in of the fact of how much of a horrifying death it is. It really is one of the worst ways to die. It's one of the worst ways to watch someone die. And I hope as few of you as possible actually watch the video of Aaron Bushnell. Burning alive, obviously we used to burn people alive at the stake, but in the UK for hundreds of years, so burning at the stake was finally got rid of in the 19th century in the UK, but for about 200 years before that, before someone was burnt alive, they would be strangled beforehand because it was regarded as such a horrific spectacle and regarded as such a horrific thing to do to someone that this was something which, even in this kind of brutal culture of execution, where they also all believed in immortal souls, it was seen as unjustifiable, even back in the 17th century in the UK, to burn someone alive. It's funny it's going to be strange for anyone watching on VOD when I suddenly like giggle after saying something horrifying, but it's just because I'm reading chat. Additionally, with suicide bombings, if you survive and it's anything apart from a nearly total failure or a total failure, you'll be radically changed for the worst. You'll be in a horrible, horrible condition. It's an incredibly painful and horrific way to die. It's a horrific and painful way to live on, if that happens, which is presumably the point. The point of self-immolation is to demonstrate a certain insane sort of fortitude and commitment to do this. This horror may be used, as people in the chat have mentioned, to incite the consciousness of those who you're opposed to. But I think a very major part of it, which is somewhat neglected, at least discursively, though we can see it happening, and it happened very obviously with Aaron Bushnell, and it can also be used to motivate third parties. For instance, the monk in South Vietnam, they were appealing to the South Vietnamese government to end discrimination against Buddhists, but also they swayed the US public and the US government by their actions, which, and they were successful in along with other forces in ending discrimination against Buddhists in South Vietnam. But a very major part of these actions is what I call inciting the believers. Inciting the believers was a phrase that al-Nusra, the Sunni jihadist group, used to describe one of their operations rooms during the Syrian civil war. And the phrase really stuck with me. It seems this is what often how self-emulation works and what it's aimed to. It's aimed at inciting to a greater height of kind of dedication, of action, the people that already believe in the thing, which I think is very much kind of the main effect that Aaron Bushnell's suicide has had. People have been sharing that post he made on Facebook when he said, like, during slavery or whatever, if you thought about what you'd be doing during slavery or all these other horrible things, it's what you're doing right now. And so this is kind of the real incitement to the believers kind of factor. One case I know a lot about in regards to, well, not a lot, I'm just repeating what I was taught in Syria. But in the 1990s, after the capture of Abdullah Öcalan, the Kurdish freedom movement had a big problem with self-immolation. Women would self-immolate on the anniversary of Öcalan's capture, which in the first year was just kind of, you know, part of a big hubbub, and probably did, was part of this grand upsurge and probably did act to incite the believers. But as other forms of protest against what the Kurds called the Black Day, the day of Öcalan's capture, as these protests wound down, a very small culture of self-immolation continued. No longer was this really, did this seem to be about inciting the believers. Rather, it had become a ritual of destruction where some of the movement's most dedicated members were killing themselves for no real discernible result, probably actually leading to the impression that the Kurdish freedom movement was, you know, a backwards movement, who are encouraging their members to do this horrifying thing to themselves. Yeah, and it was only women that were doing this, I think it evoked the image of, as Dusty points out, the widow burning, which happened historically in Europe and happened in India. Though, notably, widow burning in India was a product of modernity rather than some kind of pre-modern thing that the British had to come and stamp out. The PKK made clear that they disapproved of these immolations, but they still continued on. Until eventually in the late 90s, what the PKK did was they said, the women who are self-immolating are not martyrs, which if you're not part of a martyrdom culture might not seem like a big deal, but this is really unprecedented. Like if you are working for a Kurdish organization and you like get into a car crash, then you're a martyr. If you're doing anything for the struggle and you happen to die during it, then you're a martyr in the language of the Kurdish freedom movement. So to say that these people who were self-immolating were not martyrs was to basically say, you are in no way serving the cause by doing this. And actually you're likely being counterproductive. And after they did this, the practice petered out and stopped. The final topic to talk about before we can finally talk about Aaron Bushnell, and as someone something I was asked about earlier, is hunger strikes. Hunger strikes are very interesting, and I think of the ones we're talking about today, the account we should have of it is much more nuanced. We're trying to be nuanced, but we're not going to be extra nuanced here. A hunger strike, I take to, is something which is related to self-immolation, but it's a very long, drawn-out kind of self-immolation, which you can go back on, at least before you get to the very end of it, without really bad results. And also kind of the political threat relates to your death as a threat to kind of the authorities, whoever you're protesting against, as well as, again, another form of inciting the believers. Hunger strikes are often a weapon of last resort, which is why they're often done by prisoners. I don't know if anyone else, I don't know if this is normal, I imagine it is, but when I think of hunger strike, I think of the IRA hunger strikes in the 1970s. But also it's a frequent thing in Greece, and it's a frequent thing in Turkey by political prisoners. It's interesting, there's like this cross-cultural divergence on what's like kind of permissible to do during a hunger strike. So for instance, in Kurdish-Turkish culture, you can of course drink water, but also they eat like half a lemon a day or something like this, which kind of, you know, it, not for the sake of having any calories, but for the sake of keeping up on kind of vitamins, which kind of prolongs your hunger strike and prolongs your suffering, and allows you to keep going for longer. Hunger strikes, in contrast, and they're often done by prisoners, and also in the case of prisoners, they're more effective in the sense that the health of prisoners, and them staying alive especially, is seen as the provision of the state. So it's not just that prisoners will often do hunger strikes because it's the only option available to them, but in the case of prisoners, we would probably think that they're more effective. Hunger strikes are, in contrast to self-immolation, sometimes ordered by political organisations, but of course, I mean, I would say actually probably normally they're ordered, or at least they're coordinated with a political organisation, though often people will do it alone, but more likely in this case, when you're hunger striking alone, it's not really political, but rather more about kind of your personal conditions. But even in the case where it's ordered, the people involved are normally dedicated volunteers for obvious reasons. It's very, very easy to break a hunger strike. You can just stop, you know. And, you know, the prison authorities and whatever will be very enthusiastic in facilitating you stopping your hunger strike. So even if you're feeling kind of socially pressured to keep going by an organization, if you ask to be moved to a different prison or a different place in order to stop your suicide, you'll almost certainly have your request granted. Compared to all the things on the list, I think the hunger on all the kind of topics we're talking about today, I think hunger strikes are the thing which have the least obviously objectival nature, due to the fact that you can get the best outcome from your actions without dying or being harmed. Very often hunger strikes will succeed after, you know, someone, I don't really know how it feels to not eat for 30 days. I think at some point you stop being hungry and you just kind of go insane, but obviously people do this a lot and they don't break it, you know. So it must be something which is possible to do. Like, it's really hard to imagine. And I don't really want to read accounts of it because it sounds very unpleasant. But yeah. But hunger striking, towards the end, it has a really terrible effect on your body. But if you just do it for a while, you can end up at the end living the rest of your life without significant effects. There's something paradoxical going on here, however. Wow, someone in chat's actually done a hunger strike. gave up smoking cigarettes, yeah. There's a paradoxical effect there, where it is truly terrible for you to starve yourself to death. That's a horrifying thing to do. As kind of probably as horrifying, or not more horrifying, as the self-immolation, though kind of less effective in a kind of visceral sense because it's more spread out. But if you see someone at the tail end of a hunger strike, you will be just as horrified as you when you're watching someone burn themselves to death. And for the hunger strike to be effective, whoever authority you're appealing to has to be convinced that you're real about it. If you start a hunger strike, the authorities are convinced that you'll never actually harm yourself sufficiently to die, then the hunger strike will not be effective. So, and obviously the clearest way to convince them of this is to actually will towards it, is to will towards this horrifying thing that I don't think anyone should ever do, which is actually decide to starve to death. You should always back out at the end. I mean, obviously there's going to be exceptional circumstances. But the problem with that is if no one ever actually decided to starve themselves to death, hunger strikes would be basically ineffective. We can now finally talk about Aaron Bushnell. I'm just reading chat. But we're gonna start off with talking about two takes, which are obviously, actually three takes, which I think are certainly and obviously wrong about Aaron Bushnell. So, the two things that people have said, three things that people have said about them, which I think are obviously wrong, is one, that, you know, they try to explain the whole incident through the framework of mental illness. And they make the claim that people that are celebrating Aaron Bushnell, or at least being respectful to him, as I think we should all be, is that you're doing something wrong because you're celebrating the acts of a delusional ill man or something like this. There's no basis for him being mentally ill, apart from the fact that he's done this thing. Or if there is, it certainly didn't exist at the point where these people were claiming it did, because they immediately said he's mentally ill, even though they have no evidence apart from that he engaged in this act. It's this circular logic, and is certainly kind of a sign of a time, sign of the times, that whenever anyone does something which is kind of outside the norm, outside the acceptability, then people say they're mentally ill. And if you have like a particularly impoverished or ideological notion of mental illness, it can be true based on that definition, that simply because of engaging in this act, Aaron Bushnell was mentally ill. And obviously people who self-immolate are very often mentally ill in the relative sense, but of the evidence that we had about Aaron Bushnell and his act, we actually have strong evidence that he wasn't mentally ill in these senses, because it was clearly very thought through, it was clearly very rational, and there was no hesitation at any point. There was a reverse of hesitation. There was, as I'll get to later, rather what he showed was immense fortitude. So anyway, mentally ill, shit take, circular logic, ideological, blah, blah, blah. The most objectionable take was, of course, from those who are suffering from severe woke poisoning. They had the worst of anyone to say. Like, I think the people who with woke poisoning who said, like, you know, actually this is bad because Aaron Bushnell is a white man and he did something and people liked it and that's bad. Or because he hadn't scourged himself from all sin yet because he was still in the military. Or, you know, I even saw someone saying that he was engaged in cultural appropriation of Southeast Asian cultures by self-immolating as a white man. I think these responses are basically the left wing, such as we use that term, like the left wing of capital. They're the left wing version of the mental illness claim, where basically you just go to your first kind of resource to dismiss people, which in the case of liberals, establishment liberals, is mental illness. And in the case of wokeness, very woke people, is to basically claim it's problematic for one reason or another. Someone said self-immolation, MP, and I think that is a real motivation. I especially saw a kind of like Afrocentric people objecting to it, basically on the basis of, well, you know, this is distracting attention from us. And I would like to be focused on, and why isn't this about me? I don't think the wokeness remarks are even really worth discussing or arguing against. I just, you know, it's good to bring them up just to say, you know, this is really shit. It's hard in philosophy to say what's right, but I do find it quite easy to find, to say what's wrong. I've lost. Yeah, and the third reaction, which I think is, yeah, Nathan's right. I am snuffling and sniffling. There was also a reaction, which I think is obviously wrong. Though, you know, it obviously depends what your views on things are, but I imagine most people share mine here. There was a reaction mostly from Muslims, which portrayed Bushnell's act not as a tragedy, which may be justifiable, but rather as an act which is glorious in itself. This is obviously based on an enormous metaphysical difference, with these Muslims believing that Bushnell's righteous act delivered himself to the hand of the Almighty, rather than the reality that it led to his permanent annihilation. Yeah, I mean, this one was particularly bizarre, because obviously Aaron Bushnell didn't say rest in power to himself, right? So the logic there, I don't really see how that even starts to get off the ground. And what you're doing there is objecting to people using certain language to talk about this event, which is just like chronic woke poisoning in a different sense, which is, instead of focusing on things which actually happen, all of your focus is on how people talk about things which have happened. I mean, basically what people have said, what Yemenis people, what Palestinians have said is basically they think he was doing it in this righteous sense. I mean, unsurprisingly, I'm taking kind of a humanist position on this thing. I think that Aaron Bushnell's act led to his permanent annihilation. And if you don't believe that, I think you'd probably have a very different analysis on things. And, you know, this is why suicide was so common and righteous and noble in the ancient world, because they didn't believe it led to your permanent annihilation, normally. I think a good portrayal of a humanist position is what was said by the People's Front for the Liberation of Palestine, where they made clear a humanist position on this act while they still... I think this is the best take, which kind of portrays it as basically essentially good while still acknowledging that it's a tragedy. Interestingly, Hamas also put out a secular kind of style statement, as opposed to, I assumed it, their statement would come out and be very Islamist, but it was actually very secular, probably because it was meant to be appealing to an American audience. But I won't be reading a statement out from Hamas, both because I think Hamas is bad, but also you have to legally think in my country that Hamas is bad. I don't want to further incite things by just reading out one of their statements. So I'll now read the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine statement, in case anyone hasn't heard of it. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine expresses its full solidarity with his family and with all American sympathizers. The act of American soldier sacrificing himself for Palestine is the highest sacrifice and a medal, and a poignant message to the American administration to stop its involvement in the aggression. The Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine affirms that the act of the American soldier, Aaron Bushnell, from the U.S. Air Force, in front of the Zionist Embassy in Washington, D.C., in protest against the war on Gaza, which he called the liberation of Palestine, confirms the state of anger among the American people due to the official American involvement in the Zionist genocide war being waged in the Gaza Strip. It also indicates that the status of the Palestinian cause, especially in American circles, is becoming more deeply entrenched in the global consciousness, and reveals the truth of the Zionist entity as a cheap colonial tool in the hands of savage imperialism. The Front expresses its full solidarity with the soldier's family and all the American sympathizers who took an honorable stance and whose struggle and pressure to stop the genocide in the Strip have not ceased, confirming that the act of an American soldier sacrificing his life to draw the attention of the American people and the world to the plight of the Palestinian people, despite its tragic nature and great pain involved, is considered the highest sacrifice and medal, with the most important Poynter's message directed to the American administration that is involved in the war crimes in Gaza, and the American people have awakened and are rejecting this American involvement. Is that the what's kind of portrayed here is a statement where the action is glorified, but at the same time it's acknowledged as a tragedy. And what's interesting especially is the very existence of this message from the popular front of the, from the liberation of Palestine. I think the kind of important thing to talk about the rights and wrongs of this event is to talk about it in the context of a previous event, a previous immolation in December. There was an immolation in Atlanta, I think, in front of the Israeli embassy last December, and that immolation was certainly a bad immolation. This previous immolation failed to make clear what they were doing and why, and did not broadcast the event. The reporting afterwards noted that the person was found with a Palestinian flag, but it was unclear why they'd done it. Well, I mean, it's kind of clear why they did it, but with the media, and as Aaron Bushnell showed, because in the first few hours they tried to deny his reasoning, that you need to be incredibly explicit. Generally, also as an event, it fits better with this schematic that liberals try to impose on Aaron Bushnell, where due to kind of like the poor planning, the fact that this person didn't make like a statement beforehand, he didn't upload anything, it does seem more like the desperate cry of a mentally ill person. And they also didn't actually, as I think as far as I could tell, this person didn't die, which also indicates in one sense, poor planning, but in some sense, planning which is good, because it's bad to burn yourself to death. Furthermore, it's bad in the fact that it failed to produce any real consequences. It wasn't really remarked on, and it's spoken about more now in light of Bushnell's death than it was actually at the time. So the act was certainly wrong because it led to either the destruction of a person or horrific change for their life in their life for the worst, and while at the same time not producing any good ends. In comparison, Bushnell did everything right to make sure that his act could not be ignored nor misconstrued, and I think especially his unflinching kind of dedication and fortitude to make that final cry of free Palestine as the last words through the agony of literally burning to death really inspired people the most. That he took in this last desperate breath and then just shouted again, free Palestine. These things emerge from kind of the evident personal virtue of what is the PFLP? These things emerge from the evident personal virtue of Aaron Bushnell, but the fact that these virtues enabled him to engage in such an effective act also undermined the idea that it was the right thing for him to do. Wouldn't it be better for a person of Bushnell's obvious virtue to not kill themselves in, you know, they've killed themselves in probably the most effective way they could, but it would not be better for them to live on and continue to act for this cause and many others rather than sacrifice themselves, because the kind of virtue that they displayed here of organizational planning, of fortitude and so on is certainly something which would be effective in other cases. It would seem to me that Bushnell, in his planning, in his execution, and in the consequences it has caused, engaged in the best sort of self-immolation. But this is not enough, I think, to make it the right thing to do. That's it. I've finished. I'm done. Now I'm just reading chat. Yeah, it was hard. It's hard to kind of say anything negative about what he did, because I didn't watch the video, and I hope I never see it. But I read like kind of a careful blow by blow on the account of others. And he really did it like in such an effective way, and from everything else and from what everyone said about him, you know, it's such an impressive act. But I think the important thing to do, and as I often try to emphasize, we need to separate sentiment from what we think is right and wrong. It's very easy to conflate sentiment with what's right and wrong, but doing so is something we need to resist. I mean, people just change their minds, right? People change their minds really quick. Aaron Bushnell grew up in like a hardcore Christian charismatic compound. And then joined the military in 2020, like May 2020, then was radicalized in the summer of 2020 by the George Floyd uprising, as many, many people were. And his term in the military was expiring in May. But also, I think it would be really bad for US leftists to assume that US military personnel will not be people of high virtue. But I expect that actually, you know, among the US military, you're going to find plenty of people of high virtue. They're just in an environment which pushes them towards politics, which are usually bad. Thank you, Luke. I think the problem here was there wasn't really a way. It was really hard for me because in this sort of circumstance, there was much more opportunity, theoretically, for me to engage with chat and what chat was saying because I don't have a, I was going to say partner with me. Yeah, you're a streaming partner. But it's almost impossible to read from prepared notes and to read chat without, and I wanted this to be a product which on VOD is kind of sensible, you know, and not just full of long empty pauses. Like this one. At least, I mean, it was very funny last week reading the comments. Several comments from last week were just complaining about a bit where Ben just ummed and ahed for like 30 seconds, just solidly, and said like various words, but there was like no semantic meaning for like 30 seconds. He just couldn't get a sentiment out. And that is something, and I think it's, you know, I don't want to be mean to Ben when he's not here, but it's amazing because he's obviously very successful, much more successful than me, and there's a reason for it, but he's so not fluent. Yeah, I mean, I could read the comments out loud, but then that makes it much worse for the VOD, I think, because I'm often going to be reading things out loud, which I then decide not to comment on, or I decide aren't really important, and then, you know, the VOD is then full of just random comments. Yeah, I guess people find the ums and ahs charming. I mean, it does make him feel like, you know, it's very easy to talk to him because obviously it just feels like you're just chatting normally. There's no form, it doesn't feel formalistic at all. I was considering just, you know, doing it. I was considering doing it as like a pseudo monologue. Where I would have Faithy 13 from the TIR chat just here with me, just to be the person to like bounce things off of. And I also thought of maybe just getting him in and then using him to kind of like filter chat to show things up for me. But then I was like, no, I'm going to be brave and I'm going to just try it out alone because I've never monologued anything at all. So I'm just going to jump in two-footed live and see how it goes. Also, is my ring light on too high? I think my ring light's on too high. We've also got $12 in donations, which will more than make up for the fact of this stream possibly getting demonetized. So it just shows, you know, you just got to make what the people want, regardless of what YouTube wants. And in the end, you'll benefit. Well, thanks, everyone. Thanks for being so kind. I would like to have engaged, to have kept like a running record of comments or something, so on, and then to be able to discuss them now, or to answer questions now or whatever. But I was just unable to do that, really. I think I would just need another person to do that for me during the stream. I don't think I could really do it alone. It's really incredible that they're happening. You know, why do we do airdrops? We do airdrops to besieged areas which we can't reach by other means. But who is the besieging party that the US Air Force, is having to work around? The group that they're having to work around is their alleged very close ally, Israel and the IDF. Obviously, people give stuff about like, oh, actually, it's Hamas. But the reason that the US is doing airdrops is because of the IDF, is because of the Israeli government, and is because of the Israeli public. And all these groups are working together. They're working together now, it seems. The IDF is deliberately committing massacres around the sites of aid. They've purely created this situation, and the US and Jordan and Egypt and whoever else is airdropping, instead of actually doing something to change that, are just facilitating it. They're going along with it. They're doing whatever they can to allow Israel to do their worst, even if it leads to this pathetic situation where the US is having to airdrop stuff into Gaza. They're not even, you know, you think they could land boats. But no, it's not allowed. It's not allowed by Israel. All right, everyone. I'm gonna pack in. Thanks for being so kind, and I hope that was coherent and sensible. Where is outro button? Bye. Thank you.